So what I'm thinking is I'll maybe, if it's okay with you guys, maybe give you sort of three or four questions at a time. I'll kind of group them together, and you can we've tried to, Patricia's kind of put them in a kind of order together. There's one first, well, just to go totally kind of virtual with this, there's one that came in via email, actually from someone who's in France, which I'll just read quickly, and then we'll go to, maybe I'll give you three questions, and we'll get started. So the email, thank you for allowing me to mention my personal experience with the Free Gaza Project, even though I cannot be present. My name is Suleiman Baraka, and I am from Gaza. In the spring of 2007, I finished my doctorate at the Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris and decided to spend some time with my family in Gaza before taking up one of the many offers I received for a teaching position in the fall in the U.S. But despite these many offers and the intervention of the Union of the French Astrophysicists and other groups, I was not allowed to leave Gaza by the Israeli authorities. Many Palestinian students who visited their families during the summer of 2007, of course, shared my plight. During the year I waited in Gaza, I developed diabetes due to the harsh living conditions under the embargo. But just this month, I was able to leave Gaza thanks to the Free Gaza Project, which nonviolently defied the illegal embargo. I'm now in Paris and will come to the U.S. in October to begin my position at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute, a position I was supposed to have begun 1 year ago. So the question is, to all the speakers, you know, your reaction to these sorts of acts of peaceful civil disobedience, and you know, if you have other models or other examples like the Free Gaza Project, or just your kind of reactions to that project. A question which I guess came out of Norman Finkelstein's talk, isn't time on the side of the Israelis? Their idea seems to be waited out. After another couple of generations, they will have de facto permanent victory. And I think that's something that maybe everybody would be interested in. And then two questions, I guess, on the one-state or the two-state solution. Another one, I guess, coming out of Dr. Finkelstein's talk. You've made the case for supporting international consensus on a two-state solution and Israel's right to exist. However, you have not factored into this Israel's 60-year failure to comply with Resolution 194 and the accompanying claim that the return of the refugees would be a de facto demographic destruction of Israel. Could you please comment on this? And again, this was something that came up in Issa Mikkel's talk as well, the question of the refugees. And then one more, which I'll give you, and then I'll let you guys go around. Do you think that the settlements, which are now so extensive in the West Bank and continue to expand daily, have made a two-state solution impossible at this point? So maybe you guys could chew on those, and then we'll get to the next round.
I think our problem is to give brief answers which would not be satisfying, or long answers which will consume too much time, and I have to figure out which will be most effective. Let me just speak first in the question on whether time is on the side of the Israelis. I think rather the contrary. I think time is now working against the Israelis. They suffered a major defeat in 2006 in Lebanon, and one from which I personally don't think they're going to recover. I was just recently reading a book written by a fellow supporting the Israelis, but nonetheless, it contained quite astonishing information about how significant was the defeat that Israel experienced in Lebanon in the summer of 2006. Just to cite some of the basic numbers, Israel fired or delivered 162,000 weapons in Lebanon during the war. The Hezbollah, altogether, it delivered 4,000 missiles at Israel, pretty primitive missiles, and 1,000 anti-tank weapons inside, or 5,000. In fact, Hezbollah, in the whole of the war, delivered as many projectiles as Israel did each day of those 34 days of the war. The Israeli army, they say they had 30,000 troops in Lebanon during the war. The Hezbollah says 40 or 50, but let's take the Israeli figure, 30,000. The Hezbollah, it had 2,000 troops and 4,000 militia. And in fact, all the main battles which were fought on the border, because Israel was never able to really penetrate Lebanon, all the main battles were fought with militias. It was not even the Hezbollah fighters. And Israel never faced the crack Hezbollah troops, which happened to have been stationed on the Litani, waiting for the Israeli invasion that never happened. It was a huge defeat. And it's quite clear, I think, they're not going to get their way with Iran. The balance is shifting. I'm not saying it's totally shifted, but it's shifting. And Israel is now, personally, I think, it is facing, and to use the word which they overuse, they are facing an existential crisis. When Prime Minister Olmert speaks about, in the next war, he says, be prepared, our home front is going to be attacked. Well, Israel does not have a home front. The difference between its home front and the Mediterranean is the distance I jog each morning. This is not serious. Either they're going to reach a negotiated settlement on reasonable terms, or they're going to be physically destroyed. Now, I'm sure in a lot of their minds they're thinking, well, we'll take a lot of them with us, you know, the Samson option. That may be true, but I think there are at least one hopes that after the next war in Lebanon, and it's inevitable, and it's going to be a very terrible war, it will be much worse than 2006, if Israel is defeated, and I think it will be defeated, one hopes that there will be some among the Israeli leadership who finally get the message that we really have to change our tactics, that this, the standard Israeli view is the Arabs only understand the language of force and you have to keep pounding them into submission, that strategy is not going to work anymore. And I personally don't think it's going to work anymore. Israel is not the state it once was. Most people want to live a life pretty similar to the one we live in the United States. The Hezbollah, they're very committed, they're very smart, they're very disciplined, and they're not going to be defeated. I do not believe they will be. So I don't think time really is on the side of Israelis. It may seem like it's on the side of Israelis as compared to the Palestinians, but as compared to the Arab world, I think time is working against them. Hopefully there'll be some people after that next war, which I think Israel will lose, who will come to their senses about how to achieve a reasonable negotiated settlement. The second question, which always comes up, people seem to think I'm trying to ignore the issue of the Palestinian refugees. I'm not trying to ignore it. But I think there is politically, it's not a wise strategy. It's not a wise strategy to always focus on the issues which are hardest rather than focusing on the issues which are easiest. Larry Adimu, my time when I knew him, we were both Maoists of sorts, more than of sorts. We were Maoists, period, full stop. And one of Chairman Mao's slogans, which I still think makes sense, is unite the many to defeat the few. You don't try to focus on issues which are going to divide us. You focus on what will unite us. The issue of the full withdrawal, in my opinion, is uncontroversial. The issue that East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory is uncontroversial. The issue that the settlements are a flagrant violation of international law, that's uncontroversial. And we should focus on them. Because Israel cannot win on those issues. They have completely lost if you look at the record. On the question of the refugees, there is no question, it's not disputed, open to dispute, the Palestinians have the right of return. That's not an issue. All the major human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they're on record as stating the Palestinians have the right of return. The right is not an issue. But honest people will acknowledge, unless you want to play the game of purity, that its practical application raises problems. And then we have to figure out, how do you resolve those practical problems? I'm not talking about the right. And here my view is, you have to rely on the good judgment, the reasonableness of the Palestinians to figure out how to resolve it. But you don't go around saying we want all 7 million Palestinian refugees to return to Israel. That's how you lose a cause. How do you win it? Some people will forgive me. I'm going to use the analogy I always use. I went through a 10-year battle at the pool. Most of you know. I lost the battle. I got a very good lawyer, Lynn Bernabe. She's a very close friend of mine now. Top-notch lawyer. And Lynn said, you can win if you go to court. Your case is so strong, the university doesn't have a leg to stand on. If you go to court, you can win. But she said, Norman, is that what you want to do for the next 6 years? Because that's how long 10-year battles take when you go to court. And then I had to make a decision. Do I want to invest my efforts in tenure, which means I won't be able to be working on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I'm going to be spending all my time effectively writing briefs and going back and forth to court. Is that how I want to spend my next 6 years? I said, no, not really, because frankly, I never believed in academic freedom. I think it's a farce. And so it wasn't an important principle for me. So she said, okay, I agree with that decision. She said, then you should aim for a settlement. That is to say, you're not going to get what you're legally entitled to, what's your right, but you'll get something instead. And as most of you know, or some of you know, there's no reason why most of you should know, we agreed on a settlement with DePaul. And the settlement had two components. Number one, there was an acknowledgement of a wrong done to me. The university statement read that Finkelstein was an outstanding professor and a prolific scholar. They had dirtied my name, muddied my name, dragged it through the mud for a year, not only them, but others. And they had to clean up that record. So there had to be a public acknowledgement of what was done to me. And there had to be a financial component, because like Adrian Wing, I am now unemployable. Okay, we reached the settlement, we got the statement, we got a financial component, and it was over. And I moved on. And I'm actually glad I moved on. In my opinion, the same basic principle. I'm not comparing suffering. I am not so myopic that I don't see the difference between the suffering of the Palestinian refugees and myself. I'm talking about principles. The same principle applies to the Palestinians. Israel has to acknowledge that a colossal wrong was done to the Palestinians. The current position of Israel, that we accept no legal, moral, or historical responsibility for what happened, it's a non-starter. Just as if DePaul refused to issue a public statement for me, it would have been a non-starter. No, you're going to have to acknowledge that you did a wrong, a big wrong. And then the other aspect is the financial aspect. My own view is Palestinians, my experience, perfectly reasonable. If you present to them a reasonable offer, that issue can be resolved relatively amicably. But I don't think we should start drawing lines in the sand in order to create more enemies and prove somehow this conflict can't be resolved. If we're reasonable, if we're fair, in my opinion, it is resolvable. Let's not create more problems than there already are.
Maybe I'll just add very quickly. Can you hear me? I also don't think that time is on Israel's side. I'll just add very quickly. I think I would push it even further and say that even within the borders of historic Palestine, I think time is against Israel. And not from any, I don't think from any existential point, but I think from the point of, or I should say actually is against Zionism in the sense of enforcing the idea of and the reality of a Jewish state upon the people who live between the river and the sea. I think that idea, I'm actually hopeful, crazy enough, despite all that's going on. Not hopeful for the next 5 or 10 years, but, you know, hopeful for the next 50 years. I think what you're going to see, and I have a great deal of faith in this, I think you're going to see that the logic of Zionism is going to continue to be implemented with more settlements, obviously, with the wall, with greater repression. But I think, I don't think inevitably, but I have a great deal of faith that what's going to happen then is that Zionism is going to dig its own grave. And what do I mean by that? I think ultimately you cannot keep so many people, and Palestinians are probably a majority within the borders of historic Palestine, that's to say Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. And we shouldn't forget the Golan Heights, but that's another, you know, seminar. But, you know, the idea is that you can't keep that many people, just like in South Africa, you can't keep that many people under the boot perpetually, forever. That is the insanity of Zionism in the sense that the Israeli leaders have attempted to enforce and attempted to get the average Israeli citizen to believe that what, you know, you could keep people under the boot perpetually. All you need is the United States, a lot of money, and to stay strong, and you could just keep bludgeoning them into submission, as we just heard, perpetually. I don't think you can do that. I think in some sense, and my wife thinks I'm crazy for saying this, but in some sense, the more successful Zionism is, the more certain its end is. And I think the more certain that equality between Palestinians and Israelis is, because the more settlements that are being built, and I'm not supporting the settlements by any means, they are wrong and they're illegal, but the more settlements are being built, the harder it is to remove them. And I think ultimately the idea of a two-state solution will be seen to be unrealistic. The idea of a one-state solution, and I think this will probably be a very interesting conversation to have, but the idea of a one-state solution is often seen to be unrealistic, pie in the sky. The Israelis will never go for it. How do you get the Palestinian refugees back? It'll never happen. How many people have been to the West Bank? How many people have seen one of the settlements? And I'm not talking about one of these little rinky-dink settlements that were in the Gaza Strip. I'm talking about Gilo, Ariel. What do they look like? I'm sorry? Great. They're huge cities. Huge fortresses of concrete, and obviously you can't just judge by the physicality of it. But if one day I sat there and I looked at one of them, I think it was Gilo, and I said, "This is never going anywhere. This is not going anywhere. Don't fool yourself." And I think Palestinian activists and our supporters most of them like to believe that it will, but I don't think it will. And I think ultimately, Gilo and Ariel and Maale Adumim will be the death of apartheid, because I think the more you intertwine people, the more difficult it's going to be to keep them apart, the more difficult it's going to be to keep one side so completely bereft of rights. I guess, I don't know, I don't remember exactly what the second question is, but maybe in the interest of time we should go on. But that's what I wanted to say about that.
So let me go through now another set of questions. There are two questions related to boycott, divestment, sanctions, and issues around them. So one question is, even using the methods described, I guess in both of your talks, and Larry's talk as well, arguments, the law, boycotts, protests, nevertheless, how do we overcome the hold of the Israeli lobby and their operatives like Dershowitz, and also the fanatical and unthinking support of both parties in Congress. And then this person adds, South African whites did not have this particular power differential to deal with. So that's one question, I guess, in addition to all the things mentioned, how to deal with, you know, both the Israeli lobby and also the question of the support of political parties. Next question, how might U.S. geopolitical interests obstruct the moves made by a boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, or, for that matter, a law-based movement? So how does U.S. geopolitics play into it? And then a couple of questions about the truth and getting out the truth. One question, it's a bit long, but I'll read most of it. Whose truth do you hold on to? We've been talking about peace for so long. What have the Palestinians done to have a state of their own? Until the last few years, they have not had a democratic government. They're now fighting amongst themselves. The PLO has been corrupt. They've lost so many opportunities. Israel has left Gaza and given up territory, but what have the results been? And then the summary is, what would any country do when their existence is threatened, and what have Palestinians accomplished for their own citizens? Another question, a shorter question. As the press becomes more corporate dominated, what are the sorts of strategies that would be effective in getting the truth out? And then I'll throw just one more in. How do you factor Israel's negotiation with Syria into the equation when you talk about the situation between Lebanon and Hezbollah and Israel? So you three can choose amongst those. If you'd like me to repeat any of them, I'm happy to. But I'll give you those to chew on. And maybe, do you want to go the same order, or is that okay? Okay.
Obviously, at the level of Congress, the lobby poses a formidable challenge, and it's silly to underestimate the problems that arise when you get to that level. And I'm not sure if we're ready to go to that level. I think now we have to operate at the level of public opinion and trying to reach out to people and trying to get the facts out. And there I think the lobby is very weak. Anybody who's had the experience in recent years of speaking publicly on this particular matter will see that the other side is unable to answer any longer. You saw the case with Jimmy Carter. They played every card they could with Jimmy Carter. They said Jimmy Carter was an anti-Semite. They said Jimmy Carter was a borderline Holocaust denier. They said Jimmy Carter was a supporter of terrorism. They said Jimmy Carter supported Nazis after World War II. They played every card they could with him. Now, is Colin Robinson still here? Has he disappeared? Oh, Colin. Well, Colin, a good friend of mine, he works for Simon & Schuster, where Jimmy Carter's book came out. He writes a book which is pretty thin, actually. It hits the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It's there for quite a few weeks. According to what Colin tells me, it sold 300,000 copies in hardback. Is that the figure? Which is a good number, right? Then Jimmy Carter goes to the Lion's Den. He goes to our panelists' alma mater. He goes to Brandeis University, a historically Jewish university in the United States. The president of the university, Yehuda Reinhardt, says, I'm not going to even show up. And he claims he has an out-of-town appointment. And then he walks into a gym, 2,000 students, overwhelmingly Jewish. And Jimmy Carter gets 2 standing ovations from the student body. And then Alan Dershowitz steps up to reply to Jimmy Carter. And the reports are, before he opened his mouth, half the audience walked out. Yeah. So the lesson I derive from that is we shouldn't turn this Israel lobby into something bigger than it actually is, because that just then becomes one more excuse for us to do nothing. And I often hear people on our side using that as an excuse and saying, well, what about the lobby and what about and what about? No. You know, God helps those who help themselves. We can't rely on inevitable, historical inevitability, and we can't use the pretext and excuse of the lobby. They're very weak now when it comes to public opinion. And we have a huge opportunity now. Now, I agree, at the level of Congress, it'll get tougher. But at the level of public opinion, we have a huge opportunity now. And if we don't exploit it, we only have ourselves to blame. On the question of the geopolitics, it would take me too long to discuss that now. But just on the most basic level, there's no question, as Larry said, that the U.S. and Israel work together. They have common objectives in the Middle East. No point in going over that. But in my opinion, the one place where they don't have a common objective is in the Israel-Palestine conflict. When it comes to Iraq, yes. When it comes to Iran, yes. When it comes to Hezbollah, yes. But if you use a moment's reflection, what does the U.S. gain from the Israeli occupation? It gains exactly zero from the occupation, and we can say it loses some, because it loses some in terms of Arab public opinion. And so when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, I do not think it's true that the key factor is U.S. geopolitics. When it comes to that local issue of Israel-Palestine, the key factor is, in my opinion, the Israel lobby. And there's a large body of evidence to show that the U.S. would be very happy if tomorrow Israel packed up its bags and left the West Bank and the conflict was over. And so there we have much more room to affect change than we have on the regional level. At the regional level, it's very tough, obviously, because the aims are pretty much, they don't just overlap, they coincide. But on the Israel-Palestine level, I don't think the problem is U.S. geopolitics. The problem is the lobby.
I just want to add that I think there will be some difficulty here. The anti-apartheid struggle, and I'm sure most of you in the audience know this, was a long struggle that came in waves. You know, there was a wave during the 50s. There was a wave during the 60s after Sharpeville. There was another wave after Soweto. In 1976, it came in waves. And with each wave, the movement got stronger. I mean, for the folks who might have been organizing after Sharpeville in the 60s, divestment would have been hard to even conceive of. But by the time we got to the mid-1970s, people were more open to the idea. And then after Soweto, it just took off. After the Soweto uprising and massacre in 76, the apartheid movement went worldwide. I mean, I remember when we took over Nassau Hall at Princeton University, we were getting telegrams from the Greek Student Organization. I mean, it was a worldwide movement. Yes, telegrams in solidarity that were smuggled in to the building, you know, letting us know that students all around the world knew about what we were doing. So it's the same thing. I think also progressive Jews in this country have a particular role to play. They have to go into their communities and raise this issue. I mean, we have many progressive Jewish organizations now that have very progressive positions on this issue. But I think, you know, that's a particular task that Jewish progressives have to play, have to go into communities and congregations and so forth and try and turn them around, those that can be turned around. And I think they can. You know, who would have thought that Jimmy Carter would have come out with that book? You know, 5 years ago, Jimmy Carter was going to, you know, who would have thought? But he came to that. And then you see how they did him, right? They wouldn't let him speak at the Democratic convention, right? You know, so, but despite that, we still have to push.
A couple of things. One, I want to deal very quickly. An important point I think is coming out here, and I think that is sort of understand, sort of pick your battles, but battles not in the military sense, but in the political sense, is to be smart about your organizing. Hello? No, this one's better. So, for example, you know, as Norman was saying, you know, if you come out and say, there was a conference that was going to happen in Chicago for BDS, a so-called national conference, and we love, as Palestinians, we love national conferences and international conferences, and then 30 people show up. What the problem was that they had a very strong platform. It called for blanket BDS. It was a very strong platform. The problem is that if you come to the United States and right from the beginning call for blanket BDS, zero people are going to come and help. What others have done, and I think what the people of Adala are doing is in some sense magical, and that's why I'm really proud to be a part of the organization. We picked a guy, Lev Levayev, who is, maybe you've never heard of him, he's one of Israel's richest businessmen, and some of you have been to our rallies. He is an excellent example of a great person to pick. We're not picking Motorola, right? I mean, who's going to take on Motorola now? Maybe 20 years from now. But right now, this guy is a great BDS target. He is heavily involved in with two of his companies building settlements in the West Bank. He has diamond mines in Namibia and in Angola. His workers in Namibia actually were recently, and I believe they still are, striking because of poor working conditions and poor pay and abuse at his mines. So there were some people in New York who, when we mentioned BDS, ran for the door. Then you don't start talking about BDS, you start talking about Lev Levayev. He's a bad guy. There's no two ways about it. He's a really bad guy. He's a billionaire who profits off of people losing their land. There's no two ways about it. And people started to come. And then you start talking about the law. Then you start talking about the refugees. Then you start talking about this. Then you start to inform people more. It's really, aside from its intrinsic value, it's an excellent wedge to much larger issues. So, you know, I think that's where you're really starting to see, I think, people becoming much smarter about it. I think one other question, there's a lot of questions, but one other question I really, really am chomping at the bit to answer, and maybe Tony can re-ask it verbatim, at least the first part. What have Palestinians done to deserve a state of their own? Is that the question? Okay, so let's assume that's a question, because I think that was verbatim. That's interesting, because that's a pretty insulting question. What you've done to deserve a state of your own? Well, you know, none of us have done anything to deserve a state of our own other than being a human being, right? I mean, I would think that, and this is not merely rhetoric, right? I mean, the notion that some people are quote-unquote ready for democracy and other people are not is deeply rooted in European racist colonial history, in which some people with lighter colored skin and with stronger armies were entitled to the benefits that presumably you and I believe that we should all have. I mean, in South Africa, in the Bantustans, there was inter-African violence. There were people oppressing other people of the same skin color, just like there's going on in Palestine. Would this person stand up and say, what have Black South Africans done to deserve a state of their own, or deserve whatever, you know, obviously it's a state of both whites and blacks, but does it deserve self-determination? I don't think so. And so when we ask these, and this is something that comes out again and again, well, the Palestinians have not, you know, they don't have a real democracy. The Palestinians, and, you know, when they elect a government that they want, then, you know, then the United States and Israel does everything to topple it. So, you know, so it's insane. I mean, it's something that we have to contend with. We can't simply brush it aside. What are these arguments? And, you know, these are attempts, I think, and one thing that you really have to keep an eye on, one thing that I believe Dershowitz in a talk at Columbia gave, along the same lines, and you have to see the mentality of this. This is something as activists you have to be aware of. He mentioned the rights, gay rights in Palestine, in the West Bank and Gaza, versus gay rights in Israel, right? Or women's rights. And the idea being that, you know, say if you're a gay person or if you're a woman, why are you supporting Palestine? If you were there, they would oppress you. So again, this is this kind of racist attempt to paint all Palestinians and all Arabs as these ogreish, backwards, scary people or non-people, right? The idea is that they don't deserve human rights. They don't deserve the same rights as we do. They don't deserve a state. They don't deserve your attention. They don't deserve your empathy, right? So you have to really be aware of these arguments because they're employed again and again. You know, everybody deserves human rights. Everybody deserves a state of their own. Everybody deserves, you know, XYZ. So, you know, it's something that's really a kind of a canard, but we can't ignore it because it comes up so frequently. And as far as the lobby, I would agree with Norman. I think it's a formidable foe or obstacle, but I don't think it's hopeless. I don't think it's quite true that white South Africans, or I should say pro-apartheid white South Africans, didn't have a strong lobby, but they had a strong lobby. You know, American business interests were some of the last to divest. Ronald Reagan, he sent an envoy to South Africa, and upon arrival, when he met with the white South African government, he said, you know, Ronald Reagan doesn't know anything about South Africa, but he knows he's on the side of the whites. True story, right? There was a strong support for South African apartheid up until, you know, Nelson Mandela becomes elected, and then all of a sudden everybody's, no, I didn't support apartheid. No, of course not. So, yeah. So, you know, it's a lot of work, and I do think the obstacles are higher, but I don't think they're insurmountable. And I don't think it's inevitable, but I have a great deal of faith in the power of human beings, you know, like you and me, to work on a grassroots level. I don't think we should deny ourselves that.
I want to just briefly comment. I wasn't at Princeton long enough, but that was a very hard struggle. Anyone who thinks it was an easy victory, at the time, actually, I don't even remember if Princeton ever did divest. And I don't, it did?
Partial.
A partial divestment. Exactly as was just said, after the fact, everyone claims they were against apartheid. When you open up New York Times obituaries, every day there's another person who was in the forefront of the struggle, and they're always white, and I'm wondering to myself, if they were all opposed to apartheid, why was it so difficult to overthrow it? The president, William Bowen, it was Bowen, you can't hide, we charge you with genocide. He was very firm. He was a very tough nut to crack, hard nut to crack. I remember when Katzenbach came, the former attorney general, and he was on some board supporting apartheid. And actually, Larry Mao says they eventually half divested, partially divested. I wasn't even around at that point. It was years, and the people were, I have to tell you, and I don't include myself, the people were amazingly committed. It was a real sight to see. Sharon Kalamkarian, Adimu, Marsha Bonner, and the great, great, great Alan Nairn.
Yes.
The level of commitment, conviction, that was hard, hard, hard work. That was not an easy, even partial victory. And we have something to learn from that. You could not believe the level of discipline. People like Sharon, I just couldn't figure out where she got her work done. And she got it done. There must have been 48 hours in her day. Because I saw her 24 working on South Africa. So how did she manage to graduate the top of the class also? And the same thing with Adimu and many others. That was hard work. And that's what we have to do. Because I don't think our cause is weaker. Actually, I think, frankly, at this point, our cause is stronger. One of the advantages we have is it's not like East Timor, buried in the back pages, whoever heard of it. Everyone's heard of Israel-Palestine. It's there every single day in the news. We don't have to drag it from the margin to the center. It's already there. And what's there is just totally indefensible. Like Larry said, I don't know much about the details, but you know there is something wrong. When the Palestinians blew up the wall, how many people sympathized with the Palestinians and how many people sympathized with Israel? You can have all the propaganda in the world, but everyone's heart went out to those people who are living in the largest open-air prison in the world. You can't disguise it. You can't cover it up anymore. You know the Joe Louis line, you can run, but you can't hide. And Israel's reached a point where you really can't hide anymore. The case is so strong. And now the responsibility is ours. And we have to be honest. If we fail, it's our fault. We did it. We can't blame anyone else but ourselves.
I don't know, someone has to tell me how we're doing on time. Do we have, and do you guys have energy for one more round of questions, or what do we say? How about you all?
10 o'clock. It's
almost, should we call
10.
It? Yeah. I mean, that, I also think that's a very nice note to end on, actually, yes. Like the last few speeches. So I think that's a really good place to close it. Thank you all, of course, for our speakers. And many thanks to all of you for your excellent questions and for everything. Please enjoy some of our refreshments before you go.
How are you doing?
I thought that was you.